Hey there. You know, if you're a frequent listener to our show, you already know that our show is brought to you by our friends over at Artillery Sports. But what you may not know is that Artillery Sports helps athletes of all types win on and off the course and court. They do this by selling quality, durable, and precision manufactured sports equipment that keeps you in the game, while also using a portion of the profits to provide the funding needed to care for our nation's veterans. With Artillery Sports, it's more than just a game. So head over to artillerysports.com today to buy the quality equipment you need to keep you in the game and to help our nation's veterans at the same time. That's artillerysports.com. Make sure you head on over there today. Oh, and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order. Welcome, everybody, to Documentary First, an inside look into documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. And today we are picking up part two with our conversation with Corey Johnson. It is actually still April 23rd and in 2025. And we're
2025.
I hate to tell you now, you have lost a year, Corey.
Yeah, I feel older.
Last year, I gave you a year. Now you've lost it again. All right. So we're going to jump in. Those of you that did not listen to the podcast before, we went
Shame
to college.
On you.
Go back and listen to it. It was awesome. We barely got started. We went to college together. Corey is an actor. He's been in lots of different things. What was the very first movie you were in?
The very first movie I was in was one of the last films John Schlesinger did. It was called The Innocent.
Okay.
And it was based on, and I want to say it's an Ian McEwan book about a guy. There was an operation it was right after the war, after World War II. It may have been the late 40s, could have been the 50s. As a matter of fact, I believe it was the 50s. It was called Operation Gold. And there were people in West Berlin, and they were trying to dig tunnels near the wall near East Berlin to tap into the phone line so that they could monitor the Russian and, you know, communist air traffic. It's not that it was a bad movie. It's just there was a wonderful cast. There was Anthony Hopkins, Campbell Scott, and Isabella Rossellini.
Wow, that's a good cast.
But as I tell people, you had an American playing a Brit, a Welshman playing an American, and an Italian playing a German.
That's
and so
weird.
It was very confused. They're all brilliant actors.
Yeah.
For some reason, it wasn't like their finest hour, but we had a blast doing
Did
this.
You? Yeah, so what year was that?
92.
And can we still watch it today?
I'm sure you can. You can find it somewhere. You know, it's not like.
And did you have a good role?
No. I was Anthony Hopkins' right-hand man.
Okay.
And you can see I was very, very, you know, just very, very young.
Did you know him?
Anthony Hopkins?
Yeah.
I knew him well enough because I helped him with some of his, they have a thing called ADR, which is dialogue replacement.
Yeah.
I was helping him with his American accent in some of the some of the scenes when he did ADR just to make sure he was pronouncing the words correctly.
Oh, what's he like?
He's absolutely lovely. He's just a wonderful guy. I think 92, we did it. I remember it must have been like October. We did it in the summer. And then around November of 92, I did the dialogue replacement. And he was knighted in the New Year's Day honors list in 1993. And I knew him well enough to call him briefly and say, congratulations, it's brilliant. What are you up to? And I'll never forget him saying this. He said, well, I said, what are you doing next? He goes, oh, I'm not really sure, but I'm booked up for the next 3 years. And I went, 3 years?
Wow.
I couldn't even imagine that. I thought it was just amazing. But
that is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was incredible.
Wow. How crazy. We should look back and see what he did in 93, 94, 95.
Yeah. Well, okay. Howard's End, Remains of the Day, you know, things like he was locking up.
Oh, Remains of the Day.
He had just done Silence of the Lambs. He had won the Oscar for Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, my gosh.
Or he was about to, and he was knighted. You know,
that's amazing. So,
yeah. He had a good year.
Well, you were learning. I mean, did you learn anything when you were working?
You do. You just don't know what it is you've learned. It's not like you can quantify it and go, ah, I've got to write this down because I learned what Anthony Hopkins. You learn by watching it, but sometimes, you know, you don't realize what you've learned. The one thing I remember from that movie was John Schlesinger was trying to get Anthony Hopkins to do something where he wanted him to be malevolent and threatening without appearing to be malevolent and threatening, or without being malevolent and threatening. He had to tell this kid that nothing would leave this site. And the line he said was, he would say nothing. And he'd say, not even a goddamn screwdriver. And it was just like, nothing leaves this site. And the kid would go, okay. And then he'd leave. And Anthony Hopkins said, it doesn't feel like it's very threatening. Because he would say, listen, Len, nothing leaves a site, okay? Not even a goddamn screwdriver, right? Nothing. And he said, it's got to be a bit more threatening. And so he'd nothing leave. And it was like, no. And John Schlesinger did something really brilliant. He said, we're going to reload the camera. So we'll take a couple of minutes. And they're just kind of sitting there. And he said, Tony, and he asked him something about Olivier. And Anthony Hopkins started talking about Olivier. And there were like five or six people around. The producer was there and about 12 other people start listening. And he starts doing his imitation of Olivier and Ralph Richardson and Gielgud and all these, because he was a brilliant mimic. And everybody's laughing and Tony is just in his element. And then somebody says, I think it was the first AD, it was a guy named David Tringham. He said, okay, I think we're ready. He said, okay, let's shoot this. And he goes, Tony, just knock one out. And he just was so loose and so relaxed. And he just went, oh, by the way, Len, I don't know if I told you, nothing leaves this site. I mean, nothing. Not a goddamn Scrooge. And it was just like, where did that come from? But it came from Schlesinger. I mean, Tony was a brilliant, brilliant actor. But that came from Schlesinger. And he knew exactly when to explode, when to calm down, when to, you know, oh, he was a wonderful director. He was old school. There's so much that goes on a film set that if it happened today, and I mean, from actors, people would get canceled right, left, and center because they don't allow it anymore.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, there are things you don't know when something's going to happen where someone is going to go, I was offended by that. I was offended by that. And you go, I can't help you. I can't help you with that. You know, Ricky Gervais did a great thing. He said, you know, people say, you know, that joke's offensive. It's like, no, the joke is a joke. It's a joke. It's just words. Well, I was offended by it. That's fine. That's fine. Don't laugh at it. Don't listen to it. But to say the joke is offensive, you're making a blanket statement about a collection of words. You know, there are words in our language that some people will use them and they're fine. Other people use them and they'll die.
That's true.
And yeah. And so
I learned that when I went to France, and these French people were using our swear words, but they meant nothing to them.
Right.
And so our Americans, who are very conservative, would just reel at them like, oh my gosh.
Right.
But these French people use them and laugh because they think they're funny.
Right.
And then they would hear their swear words. They mean absolutely nothing to me.
Right.
Merde.
Right.
Merde or putain, you know. Right. Those mean bad words, but I can say putain to you.
Right.
It's nothing.
Right.
And that's a very bad word in English, you know, that I would not say. And they're just words. But I think what I hear you saying is today, things are so touchy and sensitive that we are all on guard and we're all feeling like we have to be very careful interacting with each other. And I think we're not as free. And when you're on a set and when you're acting with others, part of the brilliance is being able to be free to interact with others. But I think
the nature of acting is in a weird way, it's about, you know, establishing a kind of a trust.
The trust, right.
And in some cases, I think 99% of the time, I mean, look, you could say, you could make the argument 99% of the population will never commit a crime in their lives. It's the 1% of the population that will or does that we have prisons for and that we have a legal system for. And you go, okay, but the legal system isn't designed simply to put people into jail. The legal system is designed so that there are parameters and rules that people follow. And when they follow them, by and large, everything's going to be great. It's the few people who take advantage of that system that get themselves in trouble. But I feel like, you know, when you see the way things were done, or, and I'm not saying, oh, it was so much better in the older days. You could curse and you could, you know, do whatever. And it was a man's world. It's not about that. It's about just, you knew what was going to happen and you knew why it was going to happen. You knew why it was supposed to happen, or you had an idea about why it was supposed to happen. And I think what happens now is you've got a lot of people who are very threatened by a lot of things that really don't have anything to do with them.
Yeah.
And instead of saying it doesn't affect me at all, everybody says, well, no, it's got to, it should. And you go, why should it? Why should I worry about that when it doesn't come into my world, you know? It's like, we're having a big thing in America. God, we're going to get into something that has nothing to do with acting, and we should probably cut it out.
What are you talking about?
No, it's just, you know, I remember Rick Santorum about 13 years ago when he was running for president said the words, when I heard John F. Kennedy talk about the separation of church and state in America, I got sick to my stomach. And the whole crowd went crazy. Yay! Because he said, America is founded. And he made this thing about how America is founded. It's a God-fearing nation and blah, blah, blah. And I said, that's not what separation of church and state means. The separation of church and state guarantees religious freedom. And religious freedom doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want. Religious freedom means someone can't tell you how to worship.
Right.
But it's become, I get to do what I want. And if I am, and here's the thing, if I get triggered by something you're doing, I can use my religion to say, I'm triggered by that and you can't do anything because I have the religious freedom to be the religion. You can't tell me how to worship. It's like, I can't. But if your worship involves child sacrifice, I can sure as hell say you're not going to do that in this country, you know? So, yeah. I understand my take on separation of church and state is what I understand it to be. And I understand there are people who see it another way. I just don't think that's got to do with, you know, the Constitution of the United States.
Well, that's true. And what we should be abiding by is the Constitution of the United States. The problem these days is now people are confused or, you know, discussing what exactly the Constitution of the United States means today or what it was supposed to mean. Anyway, we're not here to talk about politics.
It's a great document.
It is a great document. Yeah. Let's get back to your career and what you have to teach us. You know, it's interesting talking with you. I wanted to talk about advice you have for directors and for actors. A lot of people listen to our podcast who, you know, are wanting to learn about how to be a better director or a better actor or a better filmmaker. And I think, you know, we've already learned a few things just by sharing that, you know. Yeah. So your first film was The Innocent.
Yeah.
What was your biggest break when you thought, you know, I'm really an actor now?
The Mummy was the biggest role I'd ever had.
Okay.
There are things like what I took away from The Mummy is that's not what I do. It's not what I can do.
What do you mean?
Brendan Fraser was a movie star.
Yeah.
At the time. John Hannah had been in Four Weddings and a Funeral and, you know, had the most famous speech in Four Weddings and a Funeral. He did the W.H. Auden poem about, he's gone. And Rachel Weisz, now an Oscar winner. They were all film actors. I was a theater actor. I just worked in theater, done the occasional bit in front of a camera. What I did didn't feel translated to the camera. There was a thing I remember. Steve Summers said at one point, I was just standing behind the camera watching them film something, and he said, "Gotta love that Brendan Fraser." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "He always finds the camera. He always finds the camera." And I've worked with directors who will literally say, "Don't worry about where the camera is. I'll find you. Don't worry about where the camera is." So it's six of one, half dozen of the other. You know, there are times when, as an actor, you are seeking the lens, and there are times when the lens has, you make the lens find you. You know, you say, "It's happening right here." So if you want to see it, you have to, you know, and sometimes they'll shoot it behind your ear. Sometimes they'll shoot it from here. Sometimes they'll come right there. It depends on what the director wants to do. And when you used to be an actor and cameras were big and heavy and they were stuck in their place and they pretty much turned like this, a director had to stage things because he knew what the parameters of the unseen proscenium arch was.
Right.
And he would say, "I need you here. I need you there. I need you there. You knew there, and you come in around that there, and we're going to shoot it like that." And then you see the thing that the camera had to add, and we think, "Oh, what a great thing." It was necessary, was depth, because right. you could focus on someone here and be missing the person who's here. So you're focusing up there, but you're missing this. So he would have to rack the focus, and he would make a point of doing that. And you as an actor didn't need to know he was doing it. You just needed to say your lines in the way he was asking you to say it in the rhythm of the scene. They used to rehearse. You used to rehearse. You right. know, when we did The Mummy, we had something like, we had a week or so of rehearsal where we just read through some stuff. We met and read through some stuff, but then we went to Morocco and we would work on stuff before, but we didn't really rehearse. You don't really rehearse movies.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I mean, and that's so much a part of the process. And what's so hard about movies, there's so much that's hard and different. I mean, you don't film it in order. You don't work as an ensemble, really. You know, you don't work as a cast.
Well, yeah. I just did a movie for Alejandro Iñárritu. I can't tell you anything about it. I can tell you Tom Cruise was in it. I can tell you John Goodman was in it. Michael
Stuhlbarg. Can you tell me the name of it?
There is no name yet. Hmm. We rehearsed two scenes for, I'd say, about a week each. And that doesn't sound like a lot of time. These are 10-minute scenes, 10 or 15-minute scenes. We rehearsed them for about a week. And then we started shooting them. And we shot them for weeks. And we would, at one point, we did something with one scene, finished it, went to another scene, had to come back and do the first scene again because his take on the scene had shifted and he needed to get something else. He needed to shoot it again. So we went back to it. And you have to trust a director in that case. You can't go, "But my character is this and I've based my character on this. And now you're telling me he has to be that." You know, there was something that was going on in one of the scenes. I'm going to be vague. There was something that was going on in one of the scenes, and he, as a director, said, "You know, some of you might be sitting here. Some of you might be doing that. Some of you might be, I'm just going to pick something that has nothing to do with anything. Some of you might be drawing crayons on the wall." And I literally thought to myself, what idiot is going to be drawing crayons on the wall? Guess who was drawing crayons on the wall 2 weeks later?
You.
Present. You know, because it made sense. Because yeah. it was necessary that it had to happen and there was no one doing it. And I went, "Why can't I do it? I can do it." And so I started drawing like a madman, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's unusual, different than theater, is that not only do you not necessarily rehearse in order, usually you never rehearse in order, or shoot in order.
Right.
You also have to do things over and over again, like you said. So one scene, you'll shoot the exact same scene and the cameras will be in one, you know, one place, and they'll shoot another, they'll be in another area. So they have to, and you have to do the exact same thing.
Why?
Well, not the exact same thing, but you have to do the scene.
Right.
And you have to, you know, generally.
How many times in the theater do you do a completely different thing in front of an audience?
Every time.
No, you don't. You're telling me you don't use that line as your cue to come on stage? You don't You don't come on through that door. You don't walk to this place and say that line.
Yeah, those things are the same.
There are things that are set. Right.
Yeah, but there's so many variables.
Same thing in front of a camera. Same thing in front of a camera.
Yeah.
That's exactly what the guy wants to catch. He wants to catch the moment. I mean, believe it or not, he wants to catch the moment where you go, I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, I remember it now. And say it. Because he'll have that buildup, and then he'll cut away to someone else and cut back to you as you say the line. He'll miss the bit where you broke character. This is the genius of, it's why you don't, I've seen actors do this. I haven't seen an actor do this in 25 years. I haven't seen an actor do it this century. But in the 90s, I saw it a lot.
Hmm.
So, you suspect that, I'm going to try that once. Cut. I'm sorry. Cut. And the director went, I'll say cut. Just you do your job. I've seen actors go, cut. Can we cut? Can we cut? I just, you know, because.
You've seen actors today do that?
No. You don't see it anymore. You don't see it anymore. And one reason I think you don't see it anymore is that the job of a director has fundamentally changed. It's no longer. In a way, it's a shame. I love collaborating. I love collaborating. I love being on stage with someone and going, I'm looking at you and it's alive. It's going to happen. Look, I just did a play last year. Last year at this time, I was doing a play in the West End. I had one scene, and it was with this brilliant actress named Laura Donnelly. And the play was directed by Sam Mendes.
Really?
Yes. And she was great. She was just great. I used to tell her, I said, it's like watching, there was a Beckett play called, I want to say it was called Mouth. What's her name? God, I can't think of her name. Who was the Beckett actress? Billie Whitelaw.
Don't ask me.
Billie Whitelaw did it. And it was just, they had a spotlight on her mouth. And it was just like she had some kind of lipstick and white paint here, but the spotlight was like this. And all you could see was this. Oh, look, it did hearts because I thought I was doing that. And she would just sit there and do the whole play. And everything was about her mouth, and her mouth was moving like this. And after a while, it was hypnotic. You'd just stare at it. This girl had lipstick on, and she would talk to me for like, you know, she'd had these huge speeches, and she would be talking, and I would just watch her mouth doing this, just moving. And it was like hypnotic. And I would just sit there and look at her, and he kept telling me, be slower, be slower. And I would watch her, and I would have a cigarette, and I'd smoke the cigarette, and I would just watch her mouth move. And I could slow down because her mouth was it was moving so fast. I went, I'm going to be the opposite of that. And I would just smoke the cigarette and just be really slow with everything I did. But I watched Sam Mendes, and I used it euphemistically. Watching him direct at some point was like watching someone play three-dimensional chess.
Because?
Well, because he's working on levels you don't see or can't imagine yet. And I saw two moments, one of which I was directly involved in, and the other I was off stage. I was watching what he was doing. And in the second one, he worked a scene and he was tweaking something and figuring something out. And you see with him, he's going, we've done this and we've worked this and this is like that. And there's something doesn't work. He goes, everything else is fine. This doesn't work. And he gets rid of it in his mind. And he goes, okay, try moving there. Try doing this. Go here. Do that. Change this. And you just go, it's staggering watching someone who's just brilliant do this. But he's truly he's a genius at what he does. There's no word to describe something someone does. There's no adjective to describe the thing as being genius. You describe the person as being a genius, and that's a thing, not an adjective. And so it's hard because you can't say brilliant. Everybody's brilliant. In Britain, you say, oh, that's brilliant because the sun's out, you know? Brilliant. Right. It's not brilliant. It's what it does. The sun comes out, it's brilliant, you know? But there's no adjective to describe genius, and there should be, because you have to make it about the person instead of about what they do. You know, and he was just magnificent. He was just magnificent about being absolutely fearless, about taking something that worked and making it better, not worrying about throwing it away. But he did it in a way when he went, it's at a crux point, and it's not going to make things fall down before or after. It's just going to refract it in a little different way that draws the focus where it needs to be, as opposed to diffusing it. And, you know, he did that. I'm sure he did it over and over and over again. I only could speak for the two moments I saw, but I said to him, they both took my breath away because you were right. And, you know, one of them directly affected me. And this is what he did. He went like this. He went in the middle of a scene. He looked at me and went, Corey.
Oh, he just lowered his hand.
He meant sit down.
Oh, he meant sit down.
He went, I sat back down. Instead of getting up and moving, I sat back down and I went, because all of a sudden I understood everything that was going to happen. I understood the next 5 minutes. And when I did, my heart went boom, because I knew what was going on. And I just kept looking at him like this. I was going, because I could feel what was coming. All I had to do was sit there and wait and just wait. And I understood everything. And it was just, it's why you do it.
Yeah.
Those things keep you going. But those things don't happen enough anymore.
No. It is so magical. I mean, that's what I miss about the theater. I haven't done it in years. I actually had told Jeremy once the kids are older and my life slowed down a little bit. I don't know why I wait, but I miss it so much. There's just so much about the theater that's unique like that. Mm-hmm. And you don't experience it anywhere else.
Well, this movie I just did, I can't be specific about it and I won't be, but I will say, you know, I'm watching some really brilliant actors, famous actors, doing things that are so completely and utterly selfless. You know, watching John Goodman apparently hurt his hip on this movie. Now, I will say that from me watching him, John Goodman was in a degree of pain that I can't quantify. I didn't understand it. He didn't talk about it. But you can tell when someone is just struggling with forces outside of their, you know, what their acting thing is about. And there were only moments when you sort of went like this. He didn't waste any energy trying to be bon vivant. He just came in, did his job, was always up, was always ready, but he was marshaling his forces because he knew he didn't have any energy to waste. Mm-hmm. Michael Stuhlbarg would sit there and he would absorb things and the things that other people were doing, and the camera is on him and he's just reacting. It'll never be on him in the movie for extended periods of time, but you could have had an entire film about him reacting because his reactions were so complete and whole and expressive and funny. And just, you'd hold your breath because you were going, please don't let it end. Don't say cut. Just let him keep going. Because it was just brilliant. There's an actor named Riz Ahmed, who was in The Night Of. He was in, it was a thing about a drummer, a heavy metal drummer who's going deaf. I can't remember what the name of it was. I think he was nominated for like Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor.
That was recent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was recent, the last few years. He's just extraordinary. I remember I did a movie with him about 15 years ago, and we were talking about the Kennedy assassination. It was one of those things where he was going, well, you know, maybe. And I was going, Riz, please don't. I know about this, and I don't. And so I would watch him do stuff and I'd go, well, okay, yeah, you're not doing anything really. Fair enough. And then I'd look at the rushes and I'd go, oh my God, this guy's incredible. His mind, and this is on camera, this is what the camera is receiving. His mind is so fast and so nimble. It's like, it was impossible to understand what he was doing. You just had to try and go on his journey with him. And, you know, these are actors I'm seeing every day. And I'm just going, this is just incredible to be watching. I told the cinematographer, I said, I've been doing this a lot of years. When I work with a good cinematographer, I know exactly what he's doing. When I work with a great cinematographer, I see what he's doing and I go, oh, I get it. I never had a clue what you were up to, not an idea. I said, you were so far past brilliant. I don't know how to describe what it is you're doing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, now I want to see this movie. What kind of genre is it? Can you tell me that?
No.
Oh.
I have no idea.
Do you know when it's coming out?
No.
No, you know, well, this will be a mystery. I hope it comes out.
Here was the thing. We shot some of it on film.
Real film. Interesting. So I didn't even know that happened.
For the first time, I'm hearing while we're filming it. It was like, wow, this is weird. Okay, great. Cut. Check the gate. Are you kidding me? You know, it's like, you don't check the gate with digital anymore. You just, there's no gate. Cool.
That's super cool. Okay, so that's really awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things, you know, here you started off in theater. We've talked about a little bit about, you know, your voiceover career. Finally, you got some money doing that. And you are still doing theater. You know, I've said before in my career that I have had to diversify in order to make things work. You really do, if you're going to be in this business, a few things I've said, and maybe you agree, in order to make money, you really do have to do numerous things and piece them together, and you have to treat this like it's a business. Yeah, yes, it's your craft.
It's called show art. It's called show business.
And you have to realize that you are the product, and you have to, you know, realize you're a small business owner and treat it that way.
Yeah.
And you have
which is very hard. It's very hard.
And
I think it's easier for some people.
We weren't taught that in school.
Yeah. It's not. No. And you can't. You can't teach someone that.
No.
You kid. It's something you learn.
I disagree. I disagree. If they would have had some sort of class, a Catholic, where they taught us this, and I've talked to them about this actually, I really do feel like they should have some sort of class that teaches young kids. If you're going to go into the business of acting, you need to realize this is what you got to do. You got to set up a company. You have to get a bank account. This is how you do it. You're going to have to pay taxes. It's going to cost you money to make money. You know, you're going to need to, and this is how you'll work it. You know, you're going to need to market. You're going to need to get an agent. You're going to need to, you know, have a CPA. You're going to need to, you know, treat it like a business. And
you know how many actors who do that, who don't really work? All of them. Every single one. There isn't an actor out there who's the unemployed actors who isn't a business, who doesn't have an accountant, who doesn't pay taxes, who doesn't, all of that they do. There isn't an actor out there who doesn't already do that. And they're still not working. It's because it's got nothing to do with what the craft of acting is. These are all the things. It's like saying you need to know how to dress. Of course you do. You need to know what you need to dress for you. Of course you do. That's what you're going to learn. But these are all things you do every day. These are the things you do like you breathe. Acting should be something you do like you breathe, but it's not. Acting is a craft. Acting is something you have to work at. Acting is something you never quite finish getting good at. You know, when they say you're only as good as your last movie, that's the truth. Because if you're not getting better every time, if the movie you did 6 movies ago was your best work, get out. Stop.
Yeah.
Stop.
So you said before, I'm going to go back to, you were talking about in The Mummy, you said something about how you see Brendan Fraser and you didn't feel like this was for you or something like that.
He did something.
What did you mean?
When the director said, boy, that Brendan Fraser, he always finds the camera.
Right. And so what did that tell you about you?
There's nothing. I've been in drama school. I started at Catholic in 1982. I finished in 85. I went to London. I finished there in 88. So I did 6 solid years of training.
Yeah.
The word camera might have been mentioned twice.
Right.
Okay. No one said you have to know how to focus for the camera.
Right.
They said you need to know where your audience is.
Right.
But the audience for me was generally out there. So, you know, I learned how not to speak like this. I learned how to speak like this. Or I learned how to say something to someone who was there by talking like this and saying it like that. And at the last minute, swinging over to look at the person I was talking to on stage. But I had to project my voice out that way.
Right.
To an amorphous group of people, not to one person, to a bunch of people.
Right. And so you do have to learn the skill of bringing everything in when you're on camera for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. But you go, there's a skill of bringing everything in, and there's a skill of bringing it in and still giving it out to one particular point.
Yes.
And the one particular point you can't look at.
Yes.
You have to look past it or around it. If you, it's death if you look down the barrel.
Yes.
These are things they don't tell you, but you need to learn.
So you never took an on-camera class?
No.
Interesting. So you learned on the fly.
I don't know a lot of people. Yeah, like Simon Callow in his book said, I never took a fencing class either. What I needed to learn about fencing, I learned on the fly. You know, the first time someone says to you, don't look down the barrel, you go, okay. And then you look where the X is. Okay, great.
Interesting.
And you know, yeah, you figure that out.
Okay, so
you're just doing your job.
All right. So, but I still don't understand. I mean, did you feel like I don't fit in, or I'm not going to?
I felt like this isn't what I do. There was something.
But you've done it. You've done it.
Of course, I have.
You've continued to do it to this day.
Of course, I have. I watched them. It's like when I said I watched Riz Ahmed, and he would do his thing, and I would go, oh man, you're not even doing anything. You're just not. Don't you see that? You know, when you say, I want to believe in you, but you're making it very difficult. You should be saying, I want to believe in you, but you're making it really difficult. And he would say, I want to believe in you, but you're making it really difficult. And you go, I didn't even get anything. But then you see it on camera, and it's like, I want to believe in you, but you're making it really difficult. And you go, oh my God, that was enormous. That was huge. Because he understood something about his relationship and his character's relationship to the medium that was seeing him.
Yeah.
That I didn't get. And I still have trouble with it.
You're still learning.
I am learning, but I don't know if it's a thing I can learn or if I want to.
I disagree in some way because, I mean, I just saw September 5. I mean, you know, you had that in that movie. I mean, I felt like you did because your stuff in that film was subtle and it was, you were subtle and I got what you were doing. You haven't even watched it. You don't know. How would you know?
I don't. It's not
right.
about.
Exactly.
So here's the thing.
I don't think you can say that.
When was the last time you saw yourself on stage?
Never.
Right. So why do you think seeing yourself on film is going to teach you how to act?
Because you can learn. Listen, don't you listen to... Stop.
How do you learn when you're on stage?
Stop. Listen to me. Don't you, when you do a voiceover, don't you go back and listen?
No.
Come on now. When I am recording and doing an audition, I go back, I listen, and I try to see, okay, did I do that right?
If I go back and listen to what?
My audition.
Right. Your voiceover audition?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're recording it and sending it off.
Yeah.
Right?
But
I will do that as well. I'll record it and I'll send it off. I'll record it. I'll listen to it. I'll send it off.
Okay.
Because I don't want to have made any obvious mistakes. When you get down to, you know, I'm going to read something off of a screen that's in front of me here. To see all of the above in action and learn everything you need to know to get started and more. Here's a 5-minute video we think you'll enjoy. Now, if I was going to read that, I would say, to see all the above in action and learn everything you need to know to get started and more. Okay, hold it. To see all the above in action and learn everything you need to know to get started and more. There are three sections there. So you're going to see this in action, and also you're going to learn everything you need to know to get started, and there's more. So you're going to say, to see all the above in action and learn everything you need to go to get started and more, you know? And so that's how I would build it. I would build it like that, because as I say it, the meaning begins to reveal itself.
Yes.
The way I can most effectively reveal the meaning to someone else reveals itself. That's how I work that.
I understand, but I still think that you can learn by going back and listening or watching yourself.
Yeah, well, for me, I don't think you can, because
as you go back and listen and watch yourself, you critique yourself, and then
you watch yourself, you become self-aware. When I'm reading something, I'm providing information.
Okay.
When I'm on camera, I'm a character.
Okay.
All right. So if a director wants to say, because he's my collaborator here,
mm-hmm.
if he wants to say, make him, he can be a bit meaner there. He can be a bit less understanding. Don't make him so understanding. You know, make him more dismissive, or make him more sexist, or make him less hungry, or whatever, you know, make him more jaded. Okay, great. That's a good color to have, but that's the character's color. You know, for me to look at it and go, because you would, and don't try and tell me you wouldn't. Oh, my hair was a mess there. Oh, the makeup was just wrong. And look how my suit sat funny. I've got it, you know, that's nothing. That's got nothing to do with anything.
Well, not only would I do that, but listen, I know where you're going. I get it. And you know what? You've got a point. I've never actually thought about this.
I'm just saying that way madness lies. If you start doing that, you get further and further away from what you're doing.
That is where madness lies. I think you have a very good point there. I've actually never thought about this. But you do then begin to critique yourself in a way where you begin to doubt yourself. You begin to change, and you're then focusing on performance for performance sake, instead of focusing on A, the copy, or B, the character, and just being that. Is that what you're saying?
When they say the end justifies the means, how you get to where you want to get justifies the way you got there. But you can't use the end to make the means justify the end. That's a snake eating its own tail. If I use what I've done and look at it and say, this is how I'm going to change how I'm doing it in order to change what I've done, that's eating its own tail. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sort of. You're confusing me a little bit.
If you look at the end result in order to change the way you do something, you're lost. You're lost, you know. Part of the problem is you look at something like when Robert De Niro gained weight for Raging Bull, when Christian Bale lost weight for The Machinist, when Tom Hardy bulked up to play Bane. All those things are great, okay? All those things are great. Those performances wouldn't have been what they were without those things. It still would have been a Robert De Niro performance if he had only gained 20 pounds or if he had just looked a little bit heavier. You know? So people look at this end result and go, he gained weight. That's not why he's great. He's great because he's great. You know? Marlon Brando gained weight late in his life. That didn't make him a better actor. That just made him fat.
Or a worse one.
Yeah. He was still Marlon Brando. You know? It's just he gained weight. You know, so,
you know, it's interesting. Your approach, actually, you know, you're approaching film acting exactly the way you would approach theater acting.
Yes.
And no different whatsoever, because you're treating it. And I get now what you're saying.
Right.
You are you're not adapting yourself at all to screen acting.
I am. I can only bring what I've got. And then it's like you turn it some way.
Only slightly.
You only need to turn it slightly. when I'm on stage, you know, when I start off rehearsing, I'm not projecting my voice. I'm not, you know, standing up straight.
I'm
trying just to exist on stage and be a thing and receive information. I'm trying to receive information because the information I receive is going to affect the information that comes out.
Yeah.
If I'm standing on stage, I'm going to be, you know, disgustingly blunt right now. If I'm standing on stage with a woman and we're doing a scene and she begins taking her clothes off, if I don't somehow react to that, I'm not being true to anything that's going on. So that's information I receive, and I've got to respond in kind. You know, acting is not acting. Acting is reacting.
Yes.
Even when you're by yourself. Even when you're by yourself. You know, one of the most brilliant things I ever saw was somebody was doing Hamlet. And they started the first monologue, oh, that the tutu solid flesh. The first line of it is, "Now I am alone." And he went, everybody leaves, you know, you can go, Mom, and you, Claudius, you guys take off. And he went like this, and he just sat with the audience, and he went, "Now I am alone." And it was like, you got to be kidding me. It was just this moment where he was about to speak, and he went, "I heard something." And you thought, because it was the most brilliant bit of foreshadowing. It's like, there are ghosts in this castle. There are things you're going to hear. And he heard something, and you don't know what he heard. But then he went, "No, I'm alone. There's no one here." And it was just brilliant because it was a trigger. He did that. The actor did that. Someone may have put the idea in his head, but he did it to nothing. He did it just because he could, you know? Now, the flip side of that is sometimes you get actors who just, it's me and I'm doing my thing. And, you know, it's like I've known actors who've, I knew a guy, very famous actor. You probably know him, took over for a role that I did. It went into town. I couldn't do it. He took over. And I remember the director saying, I wanted him to move somewhere else. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, because I think, you know, he's done, you know, this and that. And he's walking over there to just, you know," like, he's, "Why?" "Well, because you've been over here and it's kind of getting tired." And he's, "But why do you want me to move?" "Well, because I've lit you over." No, I'm not going to move. I won't move. "But the lights are over there. Put the lights here. They were there. They've been there too long. It's worn out. It's got to be over." "No, I won't move." "But your character." "No, I am the character. The character is me. What I do is what the character does." And you just go, that's, again, eating his own tail. "I am the character. The character is me." That's what Stanislavski talks about when he says the magic if. You go, I know what you're saying. Your character would never be a vegan. Never. What if he was?
Mm-hmm.
What if he was? And the thing about it is once you acknowledge there's no way he was, you go, but what if he was? You just go, and it like frees you from this kind of burden of being who you are to become something you may not be. I'll probably throw this away, but let's think about this. What if he was? What does this reveal? It's brilliant, you know? Yeah. And when you collaborate with someone, like a director, in a way, as an actor, you have to be able to play that game with yourself. A director will say, "I need you to move over there." "Why?" "Because I'm telling you to." Okay. Sometimes you get a bully of a director and you go, "No, not good enough. You come up with a reason. When you come up with a good reason, I'll do it." Okay. "I'm telling you to" is not a good reason. But in the meantime, if you're a good actor, you're sitting there going, "I know he wants me to move over there. And I know he doesn't have a reason for me moving over there, but what if I did move over there? How can I make that work?" You see, the thing about it is you're thinking about making it work and you go, "I'm going to make myself vulnerable by doing this." And then he'll go, "No, you look like a pe-." And you go, "Well, then I'm sorry, then I'm not moving." And all of a sudden you close down. the thing about acting is you've got to be open to everything. You've got to allow yourself to be vulnerable. You've got to allow yourself to be injured. You've got to allow yourself to be pained. You've got to allow, and no one wants to do that. Everybody wants to project strength and dynamism and whatever it is they want to project. But the thing people want to see is what's going on behind the projection.
Yep. They want to see vulnerability, truth. They want to see you listening and
right.
Yeah. Well, once again, we're now at 50 minutes for episode 2. It's we're nowhere
gonna
be, near
we're
done.
Gonna be a season. I'm going to have my whole season. I'm going to have my own season.
You are. I love talking to you, John. I've learned so much and we are going to have to wrap this up. But I'm so sad. But I need to have you
Don't
come
be
back.
Sad.
For sure.
Yeah, we'll come back.
All right.
You'll get some people writing saying, this guy doesn't know anything about it. And they'll say, here's what he should have said. And then we can talk about that.
No, well, we'll talk about lots more. But for right now, we're going to do our last segment of DocuView Deja Vu. And I'd like you to tell me about another documentary that you've been in.
That I've been in?
That you've narrated.
What else? See, I love the Stranger Things because they're not real. They are real. These things are real, but you can't.
But they're so
say,
outrageous. I know, yes, but you told so us about. Outrageous.
But you can't say, well, these are the world's strangest things. You know, it's not like, look, I was doing a.
No, stop. You cannot go into a longer story because I have an appointment I have to get to, and I don't have enough time. Just give me a documentary.
See the one about Tiananmen Square.
Okay, good. All right. All right, everybody.
Everything's a story with me.
I know. That's why I love you. We're going to have John back, everybody. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.